This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You got your carrot in high-stakes diplomacy, and then you got your stick.
In return for Iran's actions, the international community has agreed to provide Iran with relief from certain sanctions.
The framework, I think diplomats like to call it, of a deal with Iran. Also, Janet Yellen on inequality and the guy who runs the Chinese economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 2nd of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The deal that the White House, the European Union, and Iran announced today, more of an agreement to keep on negotiating, really, is officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. It's 4 pages long, lays out a fairly specific inspection and verification regime for Iran's nuclear workings in return for that sanctions relief the president was talking about. Although, as he said at the White House,
this relief will be phased as Iran takes steps to adhere to the deal. If Iran violates the deal, sanctions can be snapped back into place.
That is actually the word in the text, by the way, snap back. Although, as we reported a couple of days ago, it might not be as easy as all that. Anyway, mark your calendars. June the 30th is the next big deadline with those Iran talks. About a month and a half ago, Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve, went up to Capitol Hill for some regularly scheduled congressional testimony. And in the course of it, she basically got into it with Representative Mick Mulvaney, Republican of South Carolina, on the subject of income inequality. I'm going to play some tape of that exchange here. It's a little bit long, but bear with me. It's worth it. Here you go.
I've described trends in income inequality in the United States. I have never said that the Federal Reserve is the right agency to deal with those when asked what contribution.
Well, then why are you talking about it?
Because
I mean, you're one of the most powerful
I've also talked about long run budget problems and deficit problems country, and they're your responsibility.
But you went to great lengths this morning, Madam Chair, and I think correctly so, to point out that you're not political. And when you start to talk about items that are outside of your direct, outside of your jurisdiction,
every
outside
Federal
of your portfolio,
Reserve
you are being
chair,
political.
All of my predecessors have talked about large, important economic trends and problems affecting the country. Whether it has to do with trade or productivity
or
developments
in energy markets. Will you agree with your predecessor that monetary policy
has an impact
on
labor rates? And I feel that I am entitled to do the same.
Labor rates.
Time of the gentleman has expired.
Thank you.
So, with that as the interesting background, I will just mention that Dr. Yellen gave another speech on income inequality today. The speech itself was fine, you know, it was an economist's speech. But it does, as we wait for what the Fed might do on interest rates, raise this question. What can the chair of the Federal Reserve, this chair of the Federal Reserve, do about income inequality anyway? Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has that one.
Some years ago, back when Larry Meyer was a Fed governor, he was asked to testify before Congress. Bernie Sanders, who's now a senator for Vermont, asked Meyer what he would do about income inequality.
And I said, nothing.
Meyer wasn't being snide. He was being honest.
This is a problem that is fundamentally outside of the control of the Fed. The Fed has a dual mandate. It's very hard to do. Full employment and price stability. Anything else? Not their job.
But even if the Fed can't control income inequality, there are two main ways it can connect its employment and price mandates to growing concerns about the yawning gap between the rich and poor. The first way is research. Randall Krosner, a former Fed governor and professor of economics at the Booth School at the University of Chicago, says the Fed has always tried to focus on more than just daily economic growth issues.
But also bigger picture issues on what are the factors that drive growth.
That is to say, figuring out, for example, whether pre-K education has a lifelong impact on an individual's ability to earn and contribute to the economy. A growing body of research, by the way, suggests that it does.
I think we now have much more data than we had before to drill down into a lot of the micro factors that may be driving macroeconomics.
The Fed has dozens of economists across the country conducting urban and rural research studies. A rallying cry like this one from Yellen could inspire the other Fed branches to direct their researchers in that direction. That's the second thing the Fed can do, use the bully pulpit. Here's Ted Peters, a former Fed director.
Having Janet Yellen publicly speak out against this carries a lot of weight.
When Yellen speaks, people listen. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, you know, it's fine. Not so bad. Come see, come saw. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're not quite there yet, but it's entirely possible the not-so-distant future here in California includes two-minute showers and brown lawns and heaven forfend unwashed cars. I kid, but it's really not funny. The drought out here got a whole lot more serious yesterday when Governor Jerry Brown ordered the first mandatory water cuts we have ever had in California, 25% to be exact. Our sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner is here to explain how it's all going to work. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so we are now in our fourth year of drought, right?
There
is no snowpack up in the Sierra. None of this is a surprise. So to channel my mother here, what took you people so long, you know?
It's true. A lot of us have been wondering this.
Yeah.
I know I live in a neighborhood where, yes, some of us are ripping out our green lawns.
Mm-hmm.
Others of us, full disclosure, have not been persuaded to do that yet. Yeah. But I think that's because the hammer hasn't come down.
Right, and here it is now.
The hammer's coming down. And we know now that these voluntary cutbacks we've had, 20%, they really don't quite make it. I talked to Felicia Marcus, the chair of the State Water Resources Control Board today. She told me that local water agencies could have slapped more restrictions on people like you and me, but they didn't.
Right.
They, for some reason during this drought, have not stepped up the way they have in earlier droughts, which is somewhat alarming to us and why there really is obviously a need for greater state leadership.
So Governor Brown wants to send a clear signal to people like you and me. This is serious.
And it's an important point, right? Local water districts. I mean, it's not like Brown controls them all. It's a diffuse set of responsibility.
Right. This is going to be mostly handled by the 400 plus water agencies around California. And they are going to decide the specifics of this. A lot of it probably, Kai, is going to be through outdoor watering restrictions because in the suburban and urban areas, on average, half of our water use goes to our lawns and our gardens. That's huge. But a lot of cities have been doing a lot of work towards this already. They probably won't have to do that 25%. But there are some districts, say in Orange County, San Diego County, their numbers are as high as 500 gallons per person per day. That's
amazing.
Huge.
That's so much water.
That's crazy.
That's
a lot of landscaping.
Man. Yeah, it is. I did a quick reader on this in the broadcast yesterday. The marketplace angle is the agriculture part of this in this state. Agriculture, though, is not officially covered by what Brown was talking about yesterday.
Right.
And that's where so much of the water in this state goes.
Right. And as we reported a couple months ago, 80%, nearly 80% of delivered water goes to agriculture in this state. This mandate, though, focuses on urban use. And Governor Brown made a point yesterday of sort of defending agriculture. He said farmers, specifically those with junior water rights, have already had a lot of cutbacks. State officials talked to you about all the land that's been fallowed. They are not ready to seriously challenge this centuries-old water rights system that we have in California.
Which is a big, complicated mess. Yeah.
Right. It doesn't mean the debate is going away, and there are crops like almonds that take up a lot of water, and people are talking about that. I think these mandatory cuts, that is going to intensify this debate over who gets how much water in California and for what purpose.
Sarah Gardner from the Sustainability Desk. I will tell you, they've been doing some amazing water coverage. It's all on our homepage, marketplace.org. Sarah, thanks, and more to come, obviously, on this.
Thanks a lot.
Aside from maybe ours, few economies on this planet are more closely watched than China's. It's the second biggest and the fastest growing, although that growth is slowing, as you've heard. So there is a lot of attention being paid to who's running it. His name is Xi Jinping. He's the president of China, and he is the subject of a new and lengthy profile in The New Yorker by Evan Osnos, who covers foreign affairs for the magazine and, more to the point, who lived in and wrote about China for The New Yorker for about 5 years. Evan, it's good to have you on.
Glad to be with you, Kai.
I think the most interesting part of this piece, and it is a fascinating, fascinating piece, is how Xi Jinping describes his, you call it, essential project. He says it's a rescue.
This was a surprise to me. I think it's a surprise to people who watch China from far away. We look at it and it looks, of course, like we see strength.
Yeah.
I mean, we see economic force and speed and growth. But when he looks out over the landscape of his country, he says, we face a serious corruption problem. We face environmental pollution. We face unrest from Hong Kong to Xinjiang. And he sees all of these crises. So for him, he feels like he is rescuing the Communist Party from this series of threats.
And he is doing it, I think it's fair to say, through strength. I mean, that's his MO, I guess.
He grew up in a system in which power prevails. He has accumulated all of the formal and informal measures of power. So, for instance, he has made sure that he's the head of the party, but also the head of the military, the head of the state. He also has taken effective control of the police, the courts, the secret police, and he runs all of the most important committees on foreign affairs, government restructuring. So there's this very affirmative and clear effort to accumulate all of the formal structures of power.
He is, just by way of background, Xi Jinping is the son of a revolutionary. He was for many years sort of a nondescript party functionary.
If you'd asked people 20 years ago, tell me about Xi Jinping, they would have said, who?
Right.
I mean,
right.
The key moment in understanding his story came about 7 or 8 years ago when he was posted to the party secretary of Zhejiang province, which is a big prosperous province in the east. And he began to show that he had this skill in promoting free market reform. So, for instance, backing a private car company, Geely, which eventually bought Volvo, while at the same time not alienating the hardliners. He managed to keep both constituencies pacified.
The bargain in China for years and years now has been, listen, we will, the government says to the people, we will let you pursue economic gain provided you don't mess around with the politics, in essence, provided you stay happy without political rights. Xi Jinping is closing down that bargain a bit.
This is the big surprise about him, is that for years, the expectation was, we'll give you these realms of private life, sort of low-grade political communication. So, for instance, they allowed people to go online and look at websites, which were technically blocked in China but were visible if you used a little bit of technical gymnastics to reach them. And he has closed down a number of those channels because he believes, basically, that those do pose an existential risk to the future of the party. And he feels that, for instance, if you allow people to get onto Facebook, Instagram, the New York Times, a lot of the websites that are blocked these days, that those would eventually create a cumulative pressure for westernization and for liberal political ideas that he believes the party might not survive. And I think the puzzle in his strategy is, by making life more restrictive in some ways, you run the risk of driving people overseas, exactly the people that you need to keep in China, the middle class, the educated, the people who want to start businesses.
He polls, such as polling is in China, right? He polls pretty well. He's reasonably popular among the broad swath of people. The great unknown, you say, is how they feel about what he's doing with the economy.
Exactly. To the degree that we can tell, using sort of indirect measurements, Chinese pollsters have been able to figure out that he's very popular on the street. But that's largely based on the anti-corruption campaign, because he's taken down a lot of people who are symbols of what people feel is an unjust distribution of opportunity. And then also based on his efforts to fly the flag and to show that China is defending its territory and foreign policy and is asserting its rights overseas. But what we don't know is whether or not he'll be able to succeed in the economic reforms that he's trying to undertake. And when you ask people in these polls, what do you like about his policy and what do you not like? The question that they are most uncertain about is whether or not he's going to be able to reinvigorate the economy for another 30 years of growth. And for that reason, a lot of his success or failure, his legacy, will rest on his ability to re-engineer the Chinese economy for a new chapter so that it's driven more by entrepreneurship, innovation, and less by simply infrastructure and exports. And in order to do that, he has to win some pretty big political fights to beat back his opponents in the system. And that's one of the reasons why he's accumulating power so fast and so brutally.
Evan Osnos covers foreign affairs for The New Yorker. He was for many years their correspondent over there. His book about China is called Age of Ambition. Evan, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Kat.
Coming up.
If you do have this digital blueprint of the actor, if you will, there's a lot you can do in the digital realm right now.
Dead celebrities coming soon to a theater near you. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up a third of 1% today. That is 65.17,763 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ added a tenth percent, 6 points, finished at 4,886. The S&P 500 took home an extra 0.3% today, 7 points, closed at 2,066. News of that preliminary agreement to make an agreement with Iran got a mixed message in the oil patch. Phillips 66 pushed back more than 2%. ExxonMobil dipped a 10%, but Chevron was up 0.4%. From the grab bag now, McDonald's got grilled again. Get it? Grilled after yesterday's announcement that it would raise wages for workers at company-owned restaurants only. Shares were down 0.4%. Doesn't seem very charitable by investors, but make that of it what you will. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.91%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. President Barack Obama is scheduled to visit Hill Air Force Base in Utah. The Labor Department will release employment data for the month of March. And on this day in 1860, a day when there were no smartphones and no email, the Pony Express debuted and delivered mail across the country by horse for the next 18 months. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of years ago, I spent a morning up in Ventura, California, talking to Yvon Chouinard, the guy who founded Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company. And I asked him while we were talking, since he had just written a book about Patagonia being a, quote, responsible, unquote, company. I asked him if companies can really be responsible, that is, sustainable.
There is no sustainability as far as any human economic endeavor. I mean, we're polluters here. And we recognize that. All you can do is work towards minimizing the damage that you do. You'll never be sustainable.
All of that said, Patagonia sure is trying. Since that interview, the company has launched a sustainability-oriented venture capital fund, which just today announced an investment in another sustainability-oriented company. But all in all, maybe Chouinard was right, and sustainability does have its limits. Jeff Tyler went up to Ventura to find out.
This room full of sewing machines and cutting tables is like a lab where Patagonia employees experiment with new fabrics and designs. But the company has not yet found a way to make its clothing waterproof without using harmful chemicals. So today, Patagonia's venture capital fund announced an investment worth more than $1 million in a Swiss firm called Beyond Surface Technologies.
What they do that makes them unique is they don't use synthetic petroleum-based chemicals for their textile finishings. They use natural substances.
That's Phil Graves, who oversees the investment fund, called $20 million and change. He spoke openly about the company's move away from the conventional method for waterproofing clothes.
The existing technology uses fluorocarbons, which are pretty nasty things in terms of environmental impact. They take forever to degrade. And so the challenge is when you look at some of the existing alternatives that are more environmentally friendly, they don't last.
The importance of durability is a theme that comes up again later. In fact, it resurfaces in this next example, an innovation I went to see in action when Phil Graves took me surfing. I put on Patagonia's latest earth-friendly wetsuit. 60% of it's made with a plant-based bio-rubber.
When you look at the environmental benefits, it's a much cleaner process than the process that goes into making neoprene.
Graves wore one of Patagonia's traditional wetsuits that is 100% neoprene.
Well, let's paddle out and give this a shot.
All right.
That's not that cold, thanks to the wetsuit. Here comes the water. Oh, that's where it counts.
Whew. That bio-rubber wetsuit doesn't come cheap. Patagonia charges more than $500. That's about four times more than a standard neoprene wetsuit from a competing brand. Mike Russo studied Patagonia for his book, Companies on a Mission, Entrepreneurial Strategies for Growing Responsibly, Sustainably, and Profitably.
A significant part of the customer base cares and might well reward the company for its environmental programs with purchases at prices higher than they would be willing to pay otherwise.
And that new bio-rubber wetsuit is still 40% synthetic rubber. Back at Patagonia's headquarters, I met CEO Rose Marcario at the company's retail store, where I asked her about the new wetsuits.
I'm imagining that there might be some environmentalists that say, well, why get into the market at all? If you can't make a better environmentally friendly wetsuit, why not wait until you can before you enter the market?
Well, I think in our case, we enter the market and create a market so that we have a voice in the market.
Standing in front of a rack of rain jackets, I asked Marcario about the tension between the company's eco-friendly investments and its continued use of the traditional harmful chemicals used for waterproofing.
How do you deal with reconciling those two things?
That's always been a tension because we create the best gear for very extreme conditions and sometimes the best finishes for those extreme conditions of wind and snow are chemical-based.
Back at the beach, Phil Graves brought the discussion around to that idea of durability.
The issue when you look at some innovation products in terms of environmental sustainability is they don't have the performance. And then what we found is long-term, when you look at the total footprint of the jacket or the wetsuit or whatever it is, extending the life of that garment it makes the biggest difference in terms of environmental impact.
So at some level, it may be better to have a synthetic product that lasts rather than an innovative substitute that repeatedly needs to be replaced. In Ventura, California, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The seventh film in the Fast and Furious franchise opens tomorrow. Furious 7, it's cleverly called. Vengeance hits home. Producers, though, had something of a problem on their hands because star Paul Walker, you might remember, was killed in a car crash about a year and a half or so ago. While some of Walker's scenes had already been filmed, the studio had to use a variety of tricks to finish the picture. His brothers stood in as body doubles. They reused bits of footage from earlier in the series, and they employed some movie-making magic as well, mapping Walker's digital likeness onto some key scenes. Carolyn Giardina covers technology like this for The Hollywood Reporter. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
The opening line of this story is it kind of sums it all up, right? No actor is indispensable. That does sort of seem to be what Hollywood would want to do here, right? Preserve their options.
They're doing that in different ways and for a variety of reasons.
First of all, how do they do it? It's got to be all digital, right?
There are actually a number of different ways you can do it, and we've seen this in Gladiator in 2000 when Oliver Reed passed away. They used images of him to create a sort of digital map of his face, if you will, which they put onto a body double, and then they reanimated his mouth in order to make him appear in scenes.
Which does sort of make you wonder how good it can really look if they're reanimating his mouth.
I mean, even since then, technology has evolved even further. For a lot of stunt scenes, visual effects companies are already creating fully digital humans.
Wow.
And in this case, it's for the purpose of stunts where you don't want to put an actor or a stunt person in a dangerous situation.
Is every movie worth this kind of investment? Because it has to be crazy expensive, right?
what a lot of visual effects people will tell you today is if you have enough time and you have enough money and you have the talented visual effects artists as well, they can do pretty much anything. Really, one of the most difficult things that they're still trying to work on is just your eyes, because if you kind of have a vacant expression in your eyes, and we've seen this in, you know, even movies like The Polar Express, for example, when you get very close to a character looking human, but it's not quite.
Yeah.
Something doesn't feel right. It almost has a creepy sensation when you view it. It's a perceptual zone that's called the uncanny valley. And visual effects companies have been trying to work on that. Probably the toughest part of what we're talking about.
I was interested to read at the bottom of this article that now you say studios and production companies are just regularly taking digital scans or digital images at the beginning of production, just so they have it.
What my source at the end of that story also said was that he's starting to hear of instances where they're scanning them also for archival purposes. One of the first times we saw a very realistic CG actor or facial performance was The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. They used CG to age Brad Pitt, but also to make him younger. And his face was scanned for that film. So if you do have this digital blueprint of the actor, if you will, there's a lot you can do in the digital realm right now.
But then aren't we inevitably going to that place where actors, well, I guess they'll have to because they want the job, right? But they're going to say, no, you can't scan me. I mean, you have Robin Williams now saying you can't use my imagery 25 years after my death, which means no computer-generated Mrs. Doubtfire.
And also not just in motion pictures. I mean, it's been announced that they're going to create a virtual Buddy Holly performance for a show in Las Vegas. Now, in that case, that's being done with his widow and estate. But as you correctly point out, I do think these are going to raise a lot of questions going forward.
Carolyn Giardina is a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Carolyn, thanks very much.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
This final note on the way out today, which is either depressing or empowering, I'm not sure which. Actually, no, it's depressing. A new poll out from Gallup says half of all employees in this country have, at some point or another, quit their jobs to get away from a bad boss. Of course, maybe that's because of the second part of the survey. Just 35% of managers in American companies call themselves engaged. 64% say they are not engaged or actively disengaged, which is, I was right, depressing.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
I'm right, right? Life's too short. You got to like what you do. All right, the Dow up 0.33% today, 65 points. The NASDAQ added 0.1%. That is 6 points. The S&P 500 took home an extra 0.3%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.